Welcome to the brand new Orca Month Book Club. We are joined today by my co-host, Colleen Weiler, the Jessica Rikos Fellow with Whale and Dolphin Conservation, and also Eric Hoyt, who is the author of the book that we're going to be discussing today, Orca, the Whale Called Killer. He is also the author of Marine Protected Areas for Whales, Dolphins, and Porpoises, and more than 20 other books. He is a research fellow with Whale and Dolphin Conservation, the co-chair of the IUCN Marine Mammal Protected Areas Task Force, and co-director of the Far East Russia Orca Project. First of all, Eric Hoyt, a big welcome to you, and a big welcome to Colleen as well. Colleen, can you give us a little bit of information about yourself? This is your first time joining us, and I'd like to just give a little hello.
Hi, Whitney. Thanks for having me. Long-time listener, first-time joiner.
First-time co-host. It's awesome to have you.
First-time co-host. Yeah, jumping in the deep end here. I'm the Jessica Rikos Fellow at Whale and Dolphin Conservation. So I work out of our U.S. office, which is in Massachusetts, but I am West Coast-based like you. I'm down in Oregon, though. So most of my work focuses on recovery and protection for the endangered southern resident orca population. And being down here in Oregon is really nice because I kind of represent the middle part of their range. So working on getting more information out there about these orcas in Oregon and getting Oregonians really involved and engaged with their recovery. So I'm excited to join Orca Month Book Club for June for Orca Month and talk about these fantastic books and spread the orca love.
Well, thanks for joining in us today. And this is so fantastic to work together with you. So the first book that we are reading for Orca Month Book Club is Eric Hoyt's Orca the Whale Called Killer. And thank you so much, Eric, for joining us today.
A pleasure, Whitney and Colleen. I'm joining you from England. But it sounds like we're next door, so it's pretty good.
Yes, thank you, technology. Right, it's everyone these days is really utilizing technology to see each other virtually. So I appreciate you joining us today virtually.
Glad to be here.
So. Yeah. The book details your experiences as a self-proclaimed sound guy, and you went out into the waters of British Columbia with a team in attempts to create a film about orcas. And it's just a fabulous journey that you take us through in your book. Can you tell us a little bit more about, you know, how you got onto the boat and how you started this project? You almost make it sound like a really casual way that you started on this trip as just the sound guy, but really became so much more.
Well, it started very casually. It was, being in a point of my life in my early 20s when I was open to just about anything. And got an invitation to work on a film, on a short film on killer whales. I knew nothing about killer whales, knew nothing about sailing. Actually, none of us on this first expedition knew about sailing except the skipper, which put us into all sorts of interesting situations, you know, putting ourselves on the rock and rocks and man overboard and other scrapes. But we, you know, very quickly learned that we could find these orcas off northeastern Vancouver Island, you know, after about a week of sailing. And it really became an obsession. I mean, first it was just so new and so fantastic that we could see them and we could hear them and experience them in the wild. And, you know, and there was nobody else. You have to imagine a time, this is in the mid-70s, there was no one out there with whales. There was no whale watching. Whale watching was you know, it would be 20 or 30 years before there'd be whale watching of any, at any level. And we were able to meet up with really the only other two groups who were up there. One was Paul Spong and a few colleagues who were starting to set up a facility on Hansen Island to start recording the whales. And the other was Michael Bigg, who was the first scientist who studied how to identify whales, figured out how to identify them from the nicks on their dorsal fins. So it was a combination of being willing to, you know, venture out and try and do something new and different for me, and then getting very, very lucky, being there when the scientists were starting to do the work and helping them and learning along with them. And so it just became something that I ended up going back year after year for 10 summers, you know, and meeting the same whales, Stubbs and Nicola and Wavy and Hooker and all the other early whales that we identified from marks on their dorsal fins. And it just, well, it became my life. That's probably the best way to put it. But yeah, I can ramble on longer, but I think that's, you know, that sort of sets up, you know, how I got interested and how I started.
Sounds like there's some great stories that come from that initial journey and trip out on the water. Was that your, you know, you mentioned that it became your life. So did this experience really change or shape your future and your, you know, career path coming from this experience?
Well, it started, you know, I always kept a journal from when I was very young. So that was a good thing, because I was taking notes all the time, every day that I was out there. And these started out as more impressionistic notes, and later on they became more scientific. As I learned more and more about them, you know, I can't, I'm not exaggerating when I say I really knew nothing about killer whales. I mean, people didn't generally know very much, but I was not a biologist. I really was coming to it from another field, from filmmaking and sound recording. And, you know, I could take photographs. I had some skills that lent themselves to doing research and being on an expedition. But I really, you know, learned so much that first year and in the successive years. And really that shaped my future. I think the key thing was I had some political consciousness, having moved from the East Coast. I'm a dual Canadian American, but I had moved from Toronto out to Vancouver and to the West Coast to Victoria in the early 70s. And I saw all these trees being cut down, these massive trees. And it really politicized me in a way that, you know, here was this beautiful countryside, this country, and that had virgin forests and had this kind of wild feel to it that the rest of Canada and the U.S. didn't have in the same way. And yet it was being cut down and things were changing rapidly. And so that really transferred into my interest in killer whales, you know, to see what the situation with them was, that they were being captured for aquariums. They were being shot at by fishermen. We had a couple of cases the first year when they were shot at. And they, you know, all the other threats that you start to learn that they face in their daily lives. And I think about the sixth or seventh up there, about 1980, Macmillan Bloedel Limited, who were then the largest logging company in Canada, announced that they were going to cut down this last unlogged, untouched river valley on eastern Vancouver Island, and they were going to boom the logs right in Robson Bight, which was an area that we'd adopted as a kind of core area where the whales were and where we had our campsite. And we, you know, we really couldn't believe it, you know, and started to organize in terms of getting the information together. And you have to remember at that time there were no papers on orcas. You know, the original scientists, Mike Bigg and John Ford, were doing their work, but they had not really published yet. And so we had to go to them, to talk to them, to get their information. And they, you know, they were incredibly helpful and on side with all this. And, you know, we managed to persuade the logging company after putting this in the newspapers. You know, I did an article for National Geographic and for a lot of other Canadian and American publications. And this, you know, we were on the radio. We did all sorts of things, you know, talking to government ministers. And finally, the tide turned. And after 2 or 3 years, the whales were granted a very tiny area. I mean, it was about the size of a postage stamp, maybe a large postage stamp, but not much larger. And so that, in a way, that for me was my introduction to habitat and the whole idea of, you know, whales. It's one thing to save the whales, and that was the big movement, you know, coming out of the late 60s. Let's save the whales, which meant stopping the whaling. And but, you know, the whaling was stopping. You know, it was those countries were, you know, Russia was closing down. Some of the others were, at least the numbers were going way down. But then we realized what we really had to do was save their habitat, because if they don't have a place in the ocean, then what does it mean to save them? So those are the wheels that were turning around in my head at the time, and still turn around in my head.
You mentioned working with Michael Bigg. In the book, this is, you know, the early 70s when you mentioned he's just starting out. And I was really struck when reading the book about, you know, you would ask basic questions like, do the whales migrate? Are their pods fluid? And, you know, Michael Bigg seemed to be pretty humble in saying that he didn't know yet, but was taking the first steps to find out. What was it like working with Michael Bigg?
Well, that was the tremendously exciting thing, was that he was a very forthright, honest person. But we were also watching the wheels turn in his head, you know, about what these whales were doing. And I remember when I was doing the National Geographic article, asking him about the associations and you know, and the huge library of photographs that he was starting to put together. But you have to remember, this is before digital, you know, before we could actually put things on computers and look at them in a systematic way. And he was, you know, he was going to dedicate, I think he initially said he was going to dedicate a winter to sorting out these photos and who traveled with whom. And what did that mean? You know, he thought really the puzzle piece was in all those associations. And he was right. I mean, that was the real insight, that these whales, these orcas, were not randomly traveling together. They were traveling together in families, you know, and there's the female, and the female is always with, you know, as he reviewed all these photos. I mean, we'd seen some of it in the wild, you know, because you repeatedly saw the same individuals traveling. But it's another thing to go through 10 years of data and to start to look at the fact that it's, you know, it's lasted over a really long period. And he was starting to realize these are very long-lived animals, and that you know, he didn't know how often the whales would form new pods, but he thought, well, it probably happened with the females spinning off, because those females, as they had calves, would turn into kind of subpods and spend more and more time on their own and form their own matrilines. We didn't even use the word matriline then. You know, that's come up since then. But you're right. This, you know, and this is what I tried to capture in the book when I first wrote it late 70s, early 80s. You know, what it was like to know nothing and then to gradually learn a lot about orcas. And then when I did the new edition last year, I wanted to keep that core of the book, because I thought it was a really valuable thing to show what it's, you know, the excitement of learning all these things as you're going along. And, you know, and I throw in all the stories and, you know, the human stories as well as the whale stories. But then to put that in the perspective of what we're learning now and, you know, and how much we've learned since then. I mean, it's been a remarkable 30 or 40 years to, you know, and I feel so grateful and, you know, just so lucky to have been through this whole period from a time when we knew nothing about whales or very little except as carcasses on whaling ships, to a time when we really know these intimate details of their behavior and associations and their life histories. You know, it's fantastic.
We definitely have learned a lot in the last few decades from when you were out initially as part of this research and working with Michael Begg, who's really, you know, one of the original orca researchers, and from the first edition of the book. So how did you decide what to include as updates in this new edition?
Well, I wanted to give an idea of what we know now. It was difficult, but I also had a couple of agendas, as it were. I mean, one of them was to explore the habitat idea, because the original book had ended with Robson Bight and getting some protection, which was only about 7 square miles. I mean, it was tiny. And I wanted to put that into perspective of what we know now about habitat and how whales move and how pathetic that was, you know, and how, you know, we really need a lot more protection. And fortunately, we are getting that in a lot of different parts of the world. And so I talk about some of my current work. I also wanted to talk about the captures, which had ended in British Columbia and Washington State, largely because of Michael Biggs' work and Ken Balcom in Washington State, you know, who, you know, the captors used to say when they were going out in the 60s and 70s, they used to say, every time we go out there, there are thousands of them out there. You know, we're not taking, you know, any number that makes any difference. And it turned out, well, there are about 300 or 400 out there. You know, it was far fewer than they imagined. And they were capturing the same ones over and over and over again. And of course, one time in 1970, they had the entire southern community in a net, you know, with no regulations, no nothing to protect those whales. You know, they took, as I recall, 7 of them and shipped them around to different aquariums, and another 4 of them died and were taken off, and their bellies slit and were anchored offshore and washed up some months later. But the fact that we could end that series of captures, and SeaWorld was, you know, thrown out of the state after the Budd Inlet capture in 1976, was brilliant. However, since then, there have been other captures in Iceland, which I wanted to talk about, and, of course, in Russia. And as the book was coming together last year, it was about a year ago that I was just finishing the writing, we still had 10 orcas in captivity in Russia, in near Vladivostok, along with 88 or 90 belugas. And so that was, and there, you know, there was a world outcry about that. So I wanted to focus on that as well. And fortunately, those whales were released, and, you know, we're hoping that orca captures in Russia now have come to an end as well. And the other thing I definitely wanted to do was to tell the story of the Russian orca work that I've been involved with since 2000. Because after working with, you know, after leaving Northern Vancouver Island and doing work with whales in different parts of the world and working on marine protected areas, I really wanted, you know, I do have a love of killer whales, of orcas, you know, that I really wanted to use that in a way and to find out more and in a way to sort of transfer what we'd learned in British Columbia to Russia. And with Alexander Burden, a Russian scientist, and Hal Sato, a Japanese woman that I've worked with, who's was trained at Orca Lab and is a brilliant researcher, we started a project in Kamchatka that's gone every year since 2000. And has expanded even to other areas of Russia, and you have photo ID'd, you know, with only Russian students. It's a Russian project, and at this point, I'm the only non-Russian that has any involvement in it. It's really been an amazing experience to see, you know, young Russians in the same way that we fell in love with orcas off Northern Vancouver Island. They have done the same thing. You know, it took a couple of seasons. You know, they asked me at one point, should we call them by name or should we, you know, use numbers? And I said, no, call them by name. You know, I mean, it'll help you remember it, but I remember them. But I also thought that that will be part of the personalization. And because I thought with Russia, there had been nobody studying orcas in Russia, you know, very few whale studies at all, nothing in the wild. And if we didn't develop a young generation that would be willing to do this, there was not going to be research or conservation in Russia. And so it's one of the things that I'm most happy about in terms of transferring whatever I learned and now has been taken over by these Russian students who have become, they're no longer students, they have their own students. You know, they're 5-6 PhDs and 10 MSCs come out of that through Russian universities. So that was a big part of what I wanted to also talk about in the book, that this is experience that we had in British Columbia and Washington State happened in a Russian way with a lot of nice differences, but, you know, very similar.
One of the things that you mentioned in this newer section of your book was that these Russian scientists only later became conservationists after some of the captures took place in Russia. Can you describe a little bit about what this means and why that's important to you?
Well, they were good scientists right from the start. You know, they were dedicated. They did everything they were asked, and they were, you know, they were hardly paid anything, which is similar to whale research all over the world. You know, the people do not go into it for the pay. And I thought they were starting to care about the individual whales in a way, you know, and talk about them. It was really the capture of the whales that they were studying, which happened a few days after they left for the season, that really made them change in terms of, you know, really being angry at what had happened. And it was just so lucky that we knew the fisheries inspector, the Russian fisheries inspector on that trip. We gave him a movie camera. It was not an iPhone. I mean, it was pre-iPhone days. We gave him a movie camera to film. You know, we just said, you know, you're out there. Please, can you film? Not thinking that they would necessarily be able to capture whales or anything else. Russians had no experience of doing that. In fact, we'd heard that they'd been out a couple of times before and, you know, had not gotten anywhere near them. But they succeeded in capturing them, and this whole thing was filmed, and including the deaths the death of an individual, and another female that was captured died 13 days later. So two females that we knew from three pods that were captured together were really, really moved everybody. And I remember showing this the year that after it happened, we were at the European Cetacean Society meetings in Poland. And for the first time, the Russians came to this meeting. And we showed this video of our work, which included a section with the captures, you know, showing these 30-some orcas surrounded by a seine net racing across, you know, really disturbed, smashing their tails on the surface, and then going into the nets and getting balled up in the nets, and one of them dying. And there were, you know, it was very moving for the whole group there, for all the scientists that were seeing that. There were tears, you know, and there was a lot of gasps and silence. It was a very moving experience for us. I mean, we had seen the film quite a few times by that point, but then we realized, you know, just how, well, it was a powerful moment, and it was powerful for, as I said, for those students, and they grew up that after that experience, and there was a lot of activity after that that was focused on trying to keep those whales out of nets, which we managed to do for quite a few years until they were captured again.
You mentioned that when you were just finishing this new edition, there was, you know, worldwide attention towards this whale jail with orcas and belugas in Russia, and that they were released. So what is the current status in Russia of these captures? Are they still allowing them to continue? Is there a quota this year? I mean, a lot of the research that has been done with this program has helped so much to learn more about orcas in Russia and, you know, population sizes and you know, different ecotypes. And that's really influenced the political situation as well. So what's the latest? What's the current status?
Well, the latest is that there's no quota for this year, but it doesn't mean that they can't have a quota next year. We don't know. We have some verbal assurances that it's not going to happen again with orcas. I don't think belugas are safe from captivity, however. But I think that one of the things that we were able to do was to get, with the help of several other people in Russia, to get the transient type orcas, the Biggs orcas, that eat marine mammals to get them onto the into the Red Book in Russia, which is equivalent to being an endangered species in the U.S. and means that if you get into the Red Book, then you you're not allowed to capture them, or there's certain things you have to do to promote their conservation. So we had argued this for several years, and initially the powers that be in Russia, the fisheries, wouldn't even accept the fact that there were marine mammal-eating killer whales and fish-eating killer whales, even though we've written papers in that were published internationally and published in Russia, and still they wouldn't believe it. But finally, there has been recognition, and initially Kamchatka adopted them into their red list or their red book, and now federally in Moscow they're in there, and this gives them some protection because the whales, the orcas that have been captured, are all the marine mammal eaters. They haven't been capturing the fish-eating ones. They're not in the same area where they're set up to capture.
How has your work in British Columbia and in Russia related to what you're working on now, which is marine protected areas?
Well, it's really started in British Columbia with Robson Bight, excuse me, and trying to protect that area. And that was just something that, habitat, the whole idea of protecting habitat was just something I knew I was going to be focused on. And I indeed have spent most of my time since then working on that, certainly the last 15 years. In terms of Russia, we've also worked on habitat protection there. We're lucky with the Commander Islands that is one of the largest protected areas. It's the largest marine protected area in Russia. For about 30 nautical miles around the islands is a no fishing zone. There's nothing that goes on there. I've been on Bering Island, for several weeks, didn't see a single boat, no traffic, only whales when you look out. It's quite an amazing place. I mean, we need more places like that where whales are able to live and humans are not, So I'm a big proponent of that. I think with the work I've done the last, since about 2013 as co-chair for the IUCN Marine Mammal Protected Areas Task Force and working with WDC on healthy seas, we've really focused on trying to identify what are the most important areas for whales and dolphins around the world. And we were fortunate a few years ago to get a grant from the German government and also from the French government to try to identify these habitats all across the Southern Hemisphere. So this has been a 5-6 year project that we're just finishing next year, which has gone, really will cover all of the Southern Hemisphere except the South Atlantic. And we hope to continue that. But that's, that's really putting these places on the map and then starting to think about whether the marine protected areas that exist are areas that are effective, are they in the right places? Do we need regulations for related to bycatch or shipping? Because whales get hit by ships, for noise, for all these other things. So it's not just resulting in marine protected areas, but it's It's until we know where the habitats are, where the important areas are, we can't do all these other things. So that work is, you know, grew directly from British Columbia and through my work in Russia. We were fortunate at the with the Convention on Biological Diversity meetings a few years ago to nominate the whole east coast of southeast coast of Kamchatka as an important whale area. And that was accepted even by Moscow, which really surprised us. So as some of that is also working in Russia too, which is exciting.
So Eric, it sounds like the experiences you detailed in the book in both British Columbia and Russia have really, you know, put you on this path towards working on these important issues of protected areas and habitat for marine mammals. For the orcas themselves, what do you think the impact of this book and your work has been for Pacific Northwest and Russian orcas?
Well, that's, you know, that's tough. That reminds me of what my friend and colleague, Giuseppe Notarbartolo de Sciara, Italian scientist, always says that we'll know that conservation is going to be successful when the whales notice that we've done something. And, you know, so that's always what we kind of ask ourselves, you know, when we come down to talking in the middle of the night or whatever, you know, have the whales noticed this, you know? And that's a tough one. It's really tough. I mean, I'm sure they notice the bad things, you know, when we put nets out there, when we spill oil, you know, as happened with Exxon Valdez, when we make a lot of noise, when there's too much whale watching, when there's all these things. I'm sure they're noticing that. But do they notice when there's something that's the way it should be, pristine? I don't know. It's maybe one of those tasks where you never get thanked, but you're glad you did it. I don't know. I think that was your question. Have the whales noticed? I have to be humble about that. Maybe it's the fact that they're not noticing the bad things in some few cases.
Well, I know that the book has inspired a lot of orca conservationists, researchers, activists. So I'm sure indirectly the whales are noticing in some way. The theme for Orca Month 2020 is orca love. What do the orcas mean to you?
Well, that's a really hard one. I mean, you can't see around my room, but there are a lot of orcas around. It was my first deep connection with nature and with the wild and with other beings, you know, and it was a connection that was really rich through certain whales, like Stubbs and Nicola, who were, you know, written up at length in the book. And it is one of those things that, you know, trying to define love, or, you know, and now you're trying to define orca love. So I don't know. It's something that helps you get up in the morning. You know, it's something that makes you feel good inside. Certainly when, you know, when you see them at a distance, even, you know, there's a kind of poetry of that. You know, there's a music and a poetry. To me, it really fills a lot of senses, you know, and I get that with photographs and reading about them and, you know, film and video footage, as well as, you know, the few times I get out into the wild. So that's orca love for me.
I think that's orca love for all of us, but also I really love the sentiment of, you know, have the whales noticed, and kind of going back to that, what has changed for them and our conservation efforts benefiting the whales, have they noticed? And at the end of the book, you know, you started with going out and being the sound guy on this boat and wanting to record the whales and maybe even try to communicate with them. But you said your perspective has changed to feeling that listening was more effective and observing. And that can apply for conservation work too, and listening to each other. So do you think that shift in your perspective has helped kind of define how that impacts the whales and how, you know, we're listening to them and seeing, have they noticed our efforts?
Yeah, I think we are listening in a way that we didn't before. And I think that's, you know, it is hard to get to that point. It was hard for me, or it took time to get to that point. But I think that's what we're doing when we go out into nature and appreciate it. We do a lot of listening and watching too, but listening. But when I was saying listening in the book, I meant listening to what I thought the whales were trying to tell us, you know, part of which was that they have their own lives, you know, and they need to live their own lives. And I do feel sensitive about that, not to overstudy them or overwatch them or, you know, to be too much with them, because they need, you know, they need their own lives as well. And that's, but yeah, I think it's, listening is important, you know, for everything that we do. You know, that's the way you learn. That's the way you grow. That's the way you appreciate everything outside of yourself. You know, a lot of quiet listening. And I think a lot of people have come to that, and it's good. It's really good.
Well, Eric, I want to thank you again for chatting with us today. Again, the book is called Orca, the Whale Called Killer. Eric, if people want to learn more about the book or where to buy it, where should they look?
Well, you can get it through Amazon or any of the bookselling websites, or you can find out more on my own website, which is just my name.com. That's that simple, I think, really. That's all.
Well, perfect. We will be sure to include links on the podcast on our website, whalescout.org. Also, go up to orcamonth.com for more information about Orca Month and events that are going on during the month of June. As always, you can subscribe to the Whale Scout podcast on iTunes, and you can now follow along free on our YouTube channel. Thank you all so much for listening today. Thank you, Colleen. And thank you, Eric. We will talk to you again very soon.
Thank you, Whitney. And thanks so much, Colleen, as well.
Thanks, Whitney. And thanks, Eric, for sharing these stories. They're really incredible.